This program is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U from the Distance Education Department of Reformed Theological Seminary. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.
The life and times of the medieval church. And we're going to talk about now shifting back to the West and what took place. Now, in the Roman Empire of the West, beginning with Otto the First, the church began to be dominated by the German kings. We've already talked about the practice of the lay investiture and how that could be problematic. Now, a reform movement that began in Cluny in central France in 910, looking at the issues that had developed in some of the monasteries and getting away from their original calling. And typically when we talk about reforming the monasteries in the West, we're talking about Benedictine monasteries. And the reform of the Cluniacs was an attempt to go back to the strict Benedictine rule. And a key issue in the reform at this time was the independence of the church from the local control of the lords and the king. And so what the Cluniacs wanted to do, because the Benedictine monasteries were functioning under the umbrella of the German kings, and they said, no, we need to be directly related to the Pope. We need that ecclesiastical connection and not the secular lords being over the monasteries. And in that Cluniac reform, there was an attempt to try to restore this. And a part of that was the elevation of the papacy to new heights. Leo the Ninth brought reform by instituting a college of cardinals in 1059. This would set the pattern for the cardinals selecting, or electing, we should say, who would be pope. 2/3 majority of the cardinals would decide that. Gregory the Seventh, who became pope in 1073, issued a decree called Dictatus Papae, which claimed absolute power for the pope as the vicar of Christ. And in part, it read like this: the Roman pontiff alone is rightly to be called universal. He alone can depose or reinstate bishops. The pope is the only one whose feet are to be kissed by all the princes, and he may depose emperors. He himself can be judged by no one. Did you get that? He's claiming all the princes, must kiss my feet. I can be judged by no one. I'm independent, and I have absolute sovereignty. And this, or the some of the claims like this, began to be issued by the bishops of Rome in the 11th, 12th centuries and beyond. Gregory the Seventh, also known as Hildebrand, reformed the clerical practice. He again reinforced clerical celibacy. He won a number of victories over the lay investiture question, and pushing for his authority. Now, the Holy Roman Emperor, Henry IV, though, defied Gregory's claims to authority and appointed his own bishops. And he compelled them to even renounce the pope. So you see this tension with the Holy Roman Empire, which, again, think of Germany, France, that central part of Europe. And this is a very powerful individual. So Gregory and Henry are coming to a showdown. Gregory retaliated by excommunicating the emperor, and he issued a papal decree that said, I withdraw the government of the whole kingdom of the Germans and of Italy from Henry the King, for he has risen up against the church with unheard of arrogance, and I forbid anyone to serve him. So the pope is now saying all of the subjects of the emperor are now freed from a submission to him. Well, you can see this is breaking into almost open warfare. The German nobles used this as an opportunity to revolt. Henry now was in a politically precarious situation, so he humbly submitted to the Pope. And he was required to wait in the barefoot in the snow outside the castle of Canossa for 3 days, and Gregory finally forgave him. A compromise was finally brought about on the lay investiture question at the Concordat of Worms in 1122. This is where the final decision was made and confirmed by the First Lateran Council that the church would elect their own bishops, but then the king would be present to receive homage and to confer temporal rights. And here is this Dictatus Papae by Gregory the Seventh, and you'll see the strong language: "No one can judge me." And so his showdown with the emperor, he wins round one, where the emperor has to publicly repent and humble himself before the Pope. Arguably the most powerful bishop of Rome in the medieval period would be Innocent III. And Innocent is known to us in history for the great ecumenical council, the Fourth Lateran Council, that would meet in the year 1215, which really defines so much of what would become of late medieval Catholicism. He exerted significant power, that really the peak of influence in the papacy. He forced his will on the German emperors during his reign, as well as the kings of England and France, and used this particular instrument that became very popular with the Pope, something called the interdict. Which had been used previously by Gregory. With the interdict, the popes would make a declaration that within this particular realm, until I say so, there's an indefinite suspension of all the administration of the sacraments. In other words, all the regular services of the church are now forbidden until the pope removes the benedict. And it was used as an instrument to enforce their will. Now, you think about that. And there's by this time more and more development about and ideas about multiple sacraments in the church. No baptisms, no marriages, no Lord's Supper, no last rites, no ordination, and the Pope declares that until I lift the interdict, none of this. So all the priests are prohibited from their normal everyday functions with this powerful tool called the interdict. And so using this means basically to humble the secular leaders to do exactly what the Bishop of Rome wanted to do. And he was very shrewd in his usage of the interdict. So you see the, you know, this political maneuvering to basically be able to control not only the church affairs, but political affairs to the benefit of the church. And there was great resentment in the secular realm over these things. And when the secular rulers had the power to resist, they did so. But given the pervasiveness, you know, of the presence of the church throughout Western Europe by this time, you know, all the different kingdoms pretty much had been converted to Christianity. Churches everywhere, monasteries everywhere. Everyone, or the majority of the population, at least nominally Christian. And with the Pope being able to make these kinds of unilateral declarations, it was a way that they could really force the hand of the secular rulers. All right, the Fourth Lateran Council of 1215. Let's talk about this just a little bit, some of the things that were instituted as a result of this. When Innocent III purposed to assemble this great ecumenical council, huge number of bishops, patriarchs, metropolitans would come. And as he called them there, it's important to remember the reality of the historical situation, because where he had called them to deliberate upon this whole cadre of issues facing the church, he had already written out 70 decrees and canons, and he's basically asking the bishops to give their approval to what he had already decided. that was his sense of his importance and influence, you know, at this time. And of course, you know, Roman Catholic theology would in essence be that to no council is ever legitimate unless the Pope confirms the decisions of that council. And so in the Middle Ages, they really tried to enforce this kind of thing. It's only when, and every once in a while, you'll hear that from a, you know, a Roman Catholic, and when you point out the fact that some of the councils have contradicted one another, well, the Pope never confirmed that one. So it didn't come up with a legitimate opinion as a result of that. All right, well, what were some of the most important canons that emerged out of this this era? When we talk about these canons and decrees, a canon basically is a rule for the life of the of discipline, rule of life or of discipline, I should say, in the church, whereas a decree is an authoritative pronouncement. So when you hear about the canons and decrees, you know, of a conciliar meeting, that's what it's talking about. Again, a canon is a rule for life or discipline, and a decree is an authoritative pronouncement. So when we talk about the Council of Trent, we talk about the decrees and canons of Trent, just an emphasis on the different parts of these statements. Well, one that would have long-term influence in the church certainly would be Canon 1, which confirmed this dogma of transubstantiation, that this now is officially the teaching of the church, that the bread and the wine become in a real way the body and blood of Christ. And we'll look a little bit later at Thomas Aquinas' exposition of this, which will become the official explanation for how this is understood. But really, from the early 13th century, you can say transubstantiation is Roman Catholic doctrine. Canon 4, an exhortation to the Greeks. This was an appeal. Innocent was feeling, you know, pretty influential here, and he exhorts the Greeks to reunite with the Roman Church. If they're willing to accept the maxims and principles of the Western Church, then we want to welcome you back into the one fold under the one shepherd. Of course, he underscored that, I'm the one shepherd of the sheep. We'd be glad to have you back. Canon 5 was a proclamation of papal primacy, and suggesting this, that this had been recognized by all antiquity. So he's trying to underscore his own sense of his place in the church. And that after the Pope, primacy is attributed to the patriarchs in the following order: Constantinople, then Alexandria, then Antioch, then Jerusalem. So he's trying to even get the bishops to agree on what's the pecking order in the church. After me, Constantinople, and then the others. Canons 14 through 17 were statements issued about the life of the church related to irregularities among the clergy. And they talked about clergy incontinence, drunkenness, going to horse races, attendance at the plays, and no more of this. Public drunkenness by the clergy gives you an idea of some of what was taking place at that time. Canon 18 has been the one that I've found most interesting. Canon 18, the Fourth Lateran Council, says priests, deacons, and subdeacons are forbidden to perform surgical operations. And apparently, you know, when people were sick, turned to these church officials, and some of them were attempting to perform some kind of medical procedures, and as more and more knowledge about these things, I guess, was increasing, they said no longer is that a clerical function. Applies somebody's doing it. And the whole issue of the ordeals and judicial tests by using water in the hot iron. You know, we hear about the humorous, you know, ways that some of that kind of thing took place. But it is true that trial by ordeal was still being practiced to, you know, if people could walk over hot coals or can endure certain things, then they obviously must be telling the truth and others are lying. And this was putting an end to that. This is no way to administer justice. It's a rather superstitious approach. Now, Canon 21 required annual confession. And you'll see the listed there. Every Christian who has reached the years of discretion must confess his or her sins at least once a year to his or her own priest. And this now becomes a law in the church. Canon 22, before prescribing for the sick, physicians shall be bound under pain of exclusion from the church to exhort their patients to call in a priest and thus provide for their spiritual warfare. So you get this little glimpse that apparently the physicians and the priests were going at it. Because not only it says no longer can the clergy do surgical procedures, the medical doctors have got to call the priests in to offer prayer for the sick. So they were at odds with one another, apparently, and the church had to intervene. Then toward the end, canons 78, 79, Jews and Muslims must wear special dress to enable them to be distinguished from Christians. And so you see some of that prejudice against non-Christians in Western Europe. So kind of a fascinating little glimpse on the early 13th century Christendom resulting from what played out here at the Fourth Lateran Council, which is considered one of these authoritative conciliar meetings by the Western Church. Now, very important for the shifting sands of the medieval church would be the emergence of the European universities and what we call the scholastic movement. And what we see is really a transition in the means through which people are able to receive education. During the period of the Dark Ages, as we've mentioned, the only place that people could really study the Bible or read the writings of the early fathers, schoolboys could go and get an education, is where they could find educated people, which were in the monasteries. Only place you could go. Education was centered there. As more and more large cathedrals were built in the major cities and outlying areas, the seats of the bishops, often there were cathedral schools that were established. This is the place that the young boys would come, where the monks could be trained in preparation for the priesthood. And so the cathedral schools came more and more to replace the monasteries as the place where education would occur. But then with the emergence in the 12th century of these new universities, primary among them would be Paris and Oxford around the 20th century, this more and more is going to be the place where people in medieval Europe would go to get an education and study the arts, the sciences, and the queen of sciences, theology, and where you could get your bachelor's degree, added a master's degree, and also a doctorate. Typically, you could earn a doctoral degree in theology, in medicine, or in law. So more institutionalized curriculums focused on the ancient learning and the new advances in understanding medicine and that kind of thing. But central to the curriculum was always studying the queen of sciences, theology at these universities. Now, the faculties of these universities were known as the schoolmen. And they articulated this Western medieval theology of the church, integrating philosophy with theology as they fine-tuned, if you would, the heritage from the ancient church in really attempting to blend these two into one system. And one of the means that they used was attempting to integrate Aristotle's logic into the expression of Christian theology. And ironically, the way the West re-engaged with the writings of Aristotle is through their contacts with the Muslim world. The Muslim scholars had taken advantage of translating some of these texts of Aristotle into Latin, and the church was again had exposure to these ideas, and as in the universities, as they began to think about the ancient Greek philosophy, began to use some of this in explaining some of the fine points of Christian theology. Natural reason began more and more to be viewed as a complement to faith and to help one understand God's revelation. And you begin to see a shift as you move into the later medieval period, away from the old Augustinian faith-seeking understanding to, you know, using understanding to support faith. And, you know, beginning with reason and then seeing how faith then can give further explanation to those things that we cannot explain through the use of logic. So kind of a major shift that began to take place here. It's a part of what Luther and the Reformers would react to. Luther, in some of his writings, when he would cite some of the medieval theologians just to show his contempt, he would write their names upside down in the margin. And Luther's the one that made the comment. He said, "Reason is a whore. Reason is a whore." And he had this sense that the use of philosophy in late medieval theology had perverted the purity of the faith. And he saw Aristotle's writings and thinking being part of the chief culprit for this kind of thing taking place. But yet the medieval men saw these as aids that could explain the faith and saw this as useful for them. Now the 12th century is another period we point to as a time of theological renaissance and emerging out of the, again, some of the darkness in the period following the Carolingian Renaissance. And darkness, by that I mean intellectual work by theologians in the church. The church was being reformed, and as it was pushing control over the state, new social and economic conditions, these cathedral schools were being replaced by the universities, more and more interest in theological writing. And one of the chief forerunners of this Renaissance period was the great thinker Anselm. And let me say a few things about Anselm, as he stands out as one of the most important of the medieval thinkers. He's usually considered to be a forerunner of the full-blown scholastic movement, as we tend to identify that with the 12th century and later. But let me mention his influence. Eventually, he would become the Archbishop of Canterbury. He's identified with the English Church long term, although that was not his ethnic background. But he was brought in to be the Archbishop of Canterbury. Now, his theological method was, as he approached the task, was posing a theological problem and then trying to solve it on the basis of reason. Now, he admitted that I already have a Christian commitment, you know, to Christian truth, but I want to try to use reason to explain the faith. And to do this, I can show the errors of unbelievers, I can enrich the faith, and his famous statement, credo ut intellegam, that I believe so that I may understand, and unless I believe, I shall not understand. So in many ways, similar to the way St. Augustine tried to describe it, many of the scholastics will go a bit beyond that, but it's called faith-seeking understanding, is the way we sometimes describe the position of Anselm. And you see this in his approach to so many of the topics. But you see the emphasis on reason in his reflection on the reality of human existence in some of his famous arguments, such as the ontological argument for the existence of God. It's been articulated in a variety of different ways. Philosophers still have fun trying to think through this. But in essence, in the ontological argument, which shows up in his work entitled the Proslogion. Anselm gives this explanation for the existence of God, arguing for the existence of God from the nature of being itself. He says, in essence, there's something than which a greater cannot be thought to exist. In other words, there's something that's the greatest of all in conception. Nothing greater can exist. But since existence in reality is better than just existence in the mind, therefore, this being that is greater than any other thought must exist. So you begin with reason. There's got to be some reality, this being of God, that is the greatest thought someone could ever have. There could be nothing greater than that. But yet to think of something actually existing is better than just having a thought in the mind. Therefore, this great being than which nothing than which can be more conceived must exist in reality. This is the ontological argument. You may have encountered that in philosophy class in college. Sometimes it's expressed in a variety of different ways. But in essence, he says, by the very nature of being, God must be exist, because there's nothing greater than God than can be conceived in the human mind. And his really existing is compelled from the nature of existence itself. So he was delving into these esoteric kind of discussions, not to undermining his real commitment to the doctrine of the Trinity, and as though he were given some new exposition of it. But he just said, how can I use reason to help me understand this God that I worship and that I adore? And so Anselm is known for this, certainly for his piety and his prayer. You can read some of his devotional writings, but known as a keen intellect in this time in the church because of his writings and reflection. But you can see in what he's pursuing here the kinds of things that the medieval schoolmen then will pursue as they begin to have their discussions about the proverbial question of how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, and asking these esoteric questions that most people in the church would not be interested in, but trying to use human reason and pressing it to its outer limits. Can we understand the world and God himself through the use of reason? And then Luther was convinced this took the church down an incredibly dangerous track. And in Luther's own understanding of the scope of church history, it's here in the 12th, 13th century that he would say the church really lost its way through the scholasticism. And it was a sidetrack away from what she should be committed to. I want us to focus our attention now on Anselm's doctrine of the atonement, which we refer to as the satisfaction theory of the atonement, which has very clear medieval overtones to it, trying to think through the doctrine of the atonement in his framework. As a medieval man, his famous work, Care Deus Homo, Why the God-Man, tying it into the Christology, why it is important that Christ is both God and man. But before we look at his unique contribution, I would like to say a few things about the Church Fathers. Where was the thinking up to this point on the doctrine of the atonement? This is obviously a very fundamental part of our Christian theology, and as we've seen with so many things, there are a number of different ideas about this. And indeed, the Scripture gives us a number of images related to the meaning of the cross. While certainly the primary notion of substitution is there, there are a number of other nuances to the cross in terms of overcoming the forces of evil, and what God is doing through Christ in terms of Him taking upon Himself our human nature. So let me just mention a few things from the Fathers for an idea. One thing that shows up very early on in a few of the Apostolic Fathers is this idea that the Father giving the Son is a ransom for sin. And that concept of ransom is preeminent. Now, Irenaeus in the second century talks about a deliverance from the power of Satan. This is what the cross is all about. And he is known for his recapitulation theory. part of what he describes is how Jesus, in the different stages of human life that he went through, childhood, adolescence, manhood, in effect walked through all the experiences of human life and reversed the course that Adam had set humanity upon because of sin. So Christ recapitulates in himself all the stages of human life, and by his obedience, he compensates for the disobedience of Adam. So this recapitulation theory, again, notice the attention given to the importance of the incarnation itself. Now, Origen in the 3rd century is known for his statements about to Christ offering himself as a ransom paid to the devil. In effect, Origen suggests that God kind of tricks the devil and substitutes Jesus, and this ransom is paid. He could not hold on to Christ, and all souls are freed then from the power of Satan because of this ransom paid to the devil. Now, we've mentioned Athanasius several times in the 4th century and the importance for him of the incarnation and this deification of human nature, that salvation flows from the entrance of our Savior into human life. Now, Ambrose in the 5th century did talk about the idea of sacrifice. And this sacrifice is a satisfaction to the divine sentence of death. But he does not give a lot of explanation to that. Now, Augustine in that same century picks up on the Athanasian theme of the deification of human nature, and the ethical component was important for Augustine, that this sacrifice of Christ reconciles us to God. But Augustine didn't tend to distinguish between that forgiveness of sin and that rectitude of life, that the cross does both of those, our justification and sanctification. And indeed, the main issue with St. Augustine that Protestants had with him is you really do not see in St. Augustine a distinction between justification and sanctification. They are inseparable still in St. Augustine's writings. Faith working itself out by love was one of Augustine's favorite texts. So all of them recognize the importance of the incarnation, the importance of the cross, but you don't have a working out of the mechanism here. What's taking place? What's transpiring in the work of Christ on the cross and the relationship to God the Father, in the same way that we see Anselm really amplifying, I think, biblically, what we understand by the atonement. Now, before we get into that, I want to give you an idea to think about here for a moment. In this course, we've been talking about the development of doctrine on a number of different levels as we tried to progress. Notice that one of the earliest issues that emerged that we talked about is the whole question of authority, right? And we talked about the canon, the creed, and the bishop. The heresies push the point, where do we look for truth? And part of the answer that the early church fathers gave to that. Then, of course, in the time of Constantine, we talked about the doctrine of God, or the Trinity. Then as you move into the 4th and 5th century, the whole area of Christology. After it became universally accepted the way we should talk about the second person of the Trinity and the relationship to the Father sharing the same essence, then the fathers grappled with the statement that eventually emerged out of Chalcedon about the human and divine natures of Christ in one person. When we come to Anselm now, we're going to see the contribution that he makes to the understanding of the atonement. Now, here's what I want you to think about. When we typically think of systematic theology and the logic and order in which we go through the different heads of doctrine, isn't that typically the order that we use? It's just rather fascinating to see how historically these things developed with the church coming to some clarity. I will say increased clarity on these issues. Because what we've tried to say is all along the way, we don't want to say that, you know, the church really did not understand these things in their essence from earliest times. Christians always knew that it's through the death of Christ that they're forgiven. And that's the whole purpose of the cross. The Eucharist reminds us of that. But in terms of articulating it in a fuller way, theologically, and here Anselm, at the beginning stages of the scholastic movement, really begins to ask some more questions and think about this a little bit more carefully. And one of the things that Anselm does is he does say that he rejects the recapitulation theory and the ransom theory, or just these ideas that, the cross being a manifestation of God's love. And he says, no, it's more than that. And here's the essential argument that he lays out as he is going to suggest in his great work, Why the God-Man, the satisfaction which cannot be given by anyone but God and ought to be given by no one but man must be given by the God-Man. So for Anselm, the doctrine of the atonement and the Christology are inseparable, the person and work of Christ. But here in essence, again in his medieval context, he's going to speak about this in terms of God's honor being offended. Okay, medieval honor was a big deal. And so using that idea common to his culture and thinking about what the Scripture says, this is the way he spoke about it. See if you can follow his line of thought here. Very similar to the way we're used to talking about the substitutionary atonement, but he will use the term satisfaction is the primary image for Anselm. As a creature, man owes to God total submission to His will. As a creature, man owes to God total submission to His will. But man has dishonored God by his sin, and therefore God must demand satisfaction. Man has dishonored God by his sin, and therefore God must demand satisfaction. And this is where there's a debt that is owed. God is the perfect creator of the universe, and His honor has been offended here because these creatures have disobeyed me, and so they owe me a debt.
Demand a what?
A debt. Debt must be paid because His honor has been violated. In other words, there's a discalibration here, there's a debt that's owed now in to make amends for having dishonored God. Well, God cannot simply forgive, Anselm says, man, because if He were to do this, it would upset the moral order of the universe. And it would destroy God's integrity. God could not have integrity if He just said, oh, forget about it. That would destroy His moral integrity. Well, then God faced a choice, according to Anselm. There were two ways that the divine honor could be vindicated. Two ways that the divine honor could be vindicated. God could either demand punishment or satisfaction. Punishment or satisfaction. Well, if God would have demanded punishment, this would absolutely ruin the human race if He were to punish all for the violation of His honor. So God, in His mercy, chose the way of satisfaction. Well, since it was a human being, or man, generically, that has sinned, a human being must offer the satisfaction to God. It's something that a man must do. We are the offending party, one that has caused the offense, and we must make amends for that. But no person, individually, can offer more than is already owed. So, God's gift, then, is the gift of His Son. This is the solution to the dilemma. As a human being, an infinite, He died on the cross and satisfied God's honor. Only God could offer this kind of satisfaction, but it was only man who owed the debt who could pay it. But because of the perfection of Christ, there was some merit that He earned by the offering of Himself. Because He owed no debt Himself, He had not sinned. So this more than counterbalanced the demerits of sin that were owed by humanity. The Son needs nothing. And so the reward that is given to him goes to man. So the forgiveness of sins and eternal blessedness then goes to humanity in the place of the reward that is given to the Son. Again, satisfaction which cannot be given by anyone but God and ought to be given by no one but man must be given by the God-man. And the whole issue of infinity, that Christ in himself is infinite, therefore he could offer a sacrifice that was sufficient for all humanity. And of course this is very similar to ways that we are more used to talking about the atonement. But Anselm makes a very important contribution to the understanding of this role of Christ as an intermediary between God and man in the atonement, which is certainly an improvement upon some of the notions that had been considered in these earlier periods. The point I would like to make, though, is I think, you know, it's certainly legitimate to say I'm not so sure about Origen's suggestion about paying a ransom to the devil. But some of the other, you know, perspectives in terms of the sense in which the incarnation plays an important part here, the fact that Christ did demonstrate his love, that he overcame the powers of evil. I mean, there are a multiplicity of pictures, even within Scripture. In fact, I dare say, just as much as we talk about trying to define some parameters about understanding God, that we never ultimately get a handle on the mystery, I don't think we were ever fully understand in all its intricacy the great mystery and wonder of the atonement and what Christ did in the cross. I think we have the main outlines that St. Paul gives us and the variety of ways of looking at this, but you know the wonder of it all is still beyond us. And so many things of the faith, we have some insights on that and enough to really grasp it and understand what God's doing, but I don't think we ever ought to suggest that we have fully got a handle, you know, on all these things. I think much of the reality of these things will be revealed to us ultimately in their fullness in eternity. But we're thankful for the knowledge that we do have. Well, Anselm certainly has contributed to Christianity through his insight in this way. Yeah, right. He said that God could have demanded, yeah, punishment or satisfaction. God, okay. In other words, how God could have expected that this violation of his honor could have been satisfied, to satisfy God's honor. And as Anselm says, he could have expected either punishment or this satisfaction. Or in the medieval context, I probably should say it this way, that God's honor would be vindicated. If I'm speaking as a medieval person, God's honor vindicated. Yeah. All right. Now, let's talk about Peter Abelard. Now, he is one who will be condemned in his day as a heretic. But the reason he is important, because some of the ideas that he began to talk about will bear fruit into the scholastic movement. Some of the Renaissance men will continue to use some of Abelard's ideas, even into modern liberal theology. Abelard's ideas are alive and well, and I want to just share some of that with you in terms of his beginning to move the church in a more rationalistic idea. In fact, sometimes his theology is described as Christian rationalism, taking things to a real extreme. Now, he has kind of an interesting story. He's known for his infamous affair with Heloise, this young teenage girl that he was called in to be her tutor, and he gets her pregnant. And her uncle's not too happy about that, so has some ruffians come in and castrate him. Abelard you know, becomes a monk, as does Heloise. And you have this sense that they continue to love each other throughout the rest of their lives, although they, you know, owned up to the, you know, what they had done and the error of that. But we do find Heloise, as a nun, shows up at different times of his life in terms of wanting to be in close proximity to him as he would journey. But a very intriguing situation we find in Abelard in terms of some of the ideas that he begins to articulate, which even in his day the church recognized as heretical and kind of shocking to us that how these ideas have continued to be espoused in more modern times. There were at least a couple of times where he was condemned at assemblies of church leaders at Soissons and at Sens. He was at one point convicted of being a Sabellian. Later he was accused of being an Arian, which seems to imply perhaps his writings were not clear in that particular area. But apparently he was quite a great orator. Great crowds. There's testimony to thousands of students flocking to hear him when he taught at the University of Paris. Large groups there, but he was sent out from Paris because of some of his aberrant views. But as he goes out into the fields, large crowds of students come to him again. And this is times where, you know, he would live in monastic seclusion and Heloise in the convent. But there some rather humorous incidents in his life that apparently some of the monks were not too kind to him either. At one point, they even tried to poison him through the communion wine. So he had lots of enemies in lots of places. But the individual who made it a part of his life's work to curb the influence of Abelard in the church would be Bernard of Clairvaux. And we'll see how he was instrumental in the condemnation that he received at these conciliar meetings. But in terms of Abelard's theology and his theological method, I want to say a few things about this. He really did put his major focus on the use of reason in doing theology. He said one should study the biblical text without any aid. You don't need to use the church fathers or tradition. You need to apply logic and reason to theological text. In fact, he said all Christian doctrine should be explained rationally. And we need to acknowledge that the mind is free. And really, he is instrumental in turning the old paradigm of faith seeking understanding on its head. Rather than, you know, I believe, and then I understand. I begin with faith, and then I seek to understand more fully that faith that I have a commitment to. Abelard's approach was more, I only believe what I can understand. See how that gives a priority to human reason? Only believe what I can understand versus beginning with faith, and then I humbly, like Augustine did in De Trinitate, Lord, I acknowledge you, but I have a great desire to understand you more. And Abelard would say, well, you know, until I understand, I'm not going to have faith in anything. So he began to crack the door toward a rationalistic approach to theology. You know, everything is on the table, and we must understand all of these things. Significant influence there at the University of Paris, and through particularly one of his disciples, Peter Lombard. Peter Lombard. In Lombard's sentences. Now, Lombard later will become a teacher at the University of Paris himself and a bishop, but in his work that he wrote, Lombard's sentences, he dealt with systematically the heads of doctrine in theology, quoting the scriptures and the writings of the fathers and really popularizing some of Abelard's approach in terms of systematically trying to deal with theology. But on the whole, Lombard's sentences tended to be rather orthodox in terms of quoting the fathers. But so important would Lombard's sentences as a theological text be that Luther is still being required to write a commentary on Lombard's sentences as a doctoral student studying theology. I mean, this would be like, you know, Charles Hodge, you know, for Presbyterians in America for generations. I mean, it was just the book everybody had to read. But it was Lombard's sentences, and so that's some of the later connection. And part of the structure of it built on Abelard's book, Sic et Non, Yes and No. And the structure that Abelard gave was to pose all these questions, theological questions, and then give a yes and no answer. Well, we know this, we don't that, but kind of left everything open-ended, you know, to be determined by the use of human reason. But long-term, it was through Lombard's sentences. Now, where I think we could describe Abelard as uniquely being a precursor of things to come theologically would be in his area, in the area of his view of the atonement. We characterize his view often as the moral influence theory, and he straightforwardly says, "I reject, the view of Anselm. That's not where." Where he was, he didn't like the idea of a ransom paid to the devil, but nor did he like Anselm's view. He said God the Father could take no pleasure in the death of his Son as the ground of forgiveness. He felt like that was irrational. For Abelard, God is love, and he is ready to forgive apart from satisfaction. God just freely loves and offers that forgiveness. All we must do is be penitent. And what Christ did is he revealed the love of God by assuming our nature and leaving us a great example that we might be obedient. In fact, his example was so extreme that he even died, showing love for God. And this love of Christ in his ultimate sacrifice awakens the response of love in us. And this newly awakened love within us liberates us from the power of sin. And it's only in this way that we can talk about being reconciled by the blood of Christ. I found it very interesting when all the discussion in America centered around Mel Gibson's film, The Passion of Christ. You remember when that came up? And it culturally raised the question again, what's the meaning of the death of Christ and His blood? Because, you know, the film was very graphic. You know, some Christians didn't even want to go see it. But I noticed in an article in Time magazine, they were interviewing a liberal Christian thinker, and this whole issue, you know, about the blood and Christ's blood being shed for forgiveness, and this particular writer wanted to distance themselves from the traditional understanding of the blood of Christ being a substitute, his life in our place. And guess who was specifically cited as the person who articulated the view that they embraced, Abelard. Because the question was, well, you know, this doesn't sound, the interviewer, this doesn't sound like the traditional Christian view you have about the cross. Oh no, this is an ancient view. This is a view held in the medieval church by a man named Abelard. It didn't, conveniently didn't mention the fact that he was deemed a heretic in the church and he was excluded. But, Abelard reared his head again, even in that context, because, as you can tell, you know, with modern sympathies and this attempt by some to distance themselves from, you know, the, quote, bloody aspect of Christianity that, you know, modern sensibilities find offensive, that, you know, here's Abelard that says, well, certainly God could, the Father could take no pleasure in the death of His Son. He would freely, you know, just forgive. So, you know, things do have a tendency to circle back around, don't they? And these ideas potentially could be very, very dangerous. But here you had this rejection. And this is part of the reason that Bernard de Clairvaux went after Abelard, because he recognized on a number of levels how insidious and dangerous these ideas could be.
The preceding program has been brought to you by RTS on iTunes U and may not be reproduced or disseminated in part or in whole, for sale or for profit, without express written consent. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.